Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil on the ones and twos. Today's special guest, Democratic State Representative Bridget Kelly. Wanted to ask her about the householder saga. Certainly she has been right in the middle of that as a state rep, and her vote for against householder for speaker, and want to ask her about that and ask her about what's going on in the state house and where does the state house go from here. She's from right here in Cincinnati, and looking forward to having Bridget on the podcast today. Sherry, how are
you? Hi, Jason. Also, Bridget mentioned for a lot of these jobs coming up here. These are, like, she is on the short list of many, many jobs in the future. So I think we should ask her about that too.
We absolutely will. And her first time on the podcast, and certainly looking forward to chatting with her. First, let's keep it right back here in Cincinnati. And the Banks Riverfront development is back in the news. Certainly,
No, that was all settled. I'm awfully positive. I wrote a story with Scott Wortman, our county reporter, that said that was all settled. Remember, Todd and John had a big meeting.
Oh yeah, that was November. That's right.
Wait. Okay, seriously, Scott and I, we have a huge story coming. It should be posted by the time the podcast is put live, and a look back at what has happened since that meeting. We made a public records request. It took months to fill. That's a whole other story for all the emails and the communications, and it was very revealing. Right after that November 2nd meeting, things started falling apart very quickly.
Yes. What I may or may not have given you guys a tip on that, that things were starting to unravel, and there was an effort to unravel that.
I mean,
what did you guys find out about that?
Let's say real quick what the deal was. So, you know, after, you know, so many fights, right? I was joking about it, but that's a true thing. What should we do here? The music venue there, this lot, that lot. They kind of came to an agreement that was, okay, we'll develop these two and you develop these two, county and city, right? And then
seemed
we'll
pretty
be fine.
Simple.
But, you know, it really not. Of course it wasn't.
and by the way, Sherry, the city council approved that.
They did, but it turns out they just wrote up a deal themselves and signed off on it, and the county never agreed to that deal or agreed that that's what they had agreed to in that Todd meeting. And so they basically just signed off on something by themselves. It really holds no water, according to the county. It's kind of stunning, honestly.
I mean, so, Sherry, I mean, and I know this is can get in the weeds, but I think the importance here is going back to that meeting. It did, I think it's sad and unfortunate that Todd Portune has since passed, and so certainly we don't know his perspective on it today. Do you think that Todd just thought, hey, this is a done deal, and that there wasn't a need for approval from the rest of the county or the commissioners on this, or
when this was
what's
happening?
The sense you got in there?
When this was happening, Todd Portune, of course, died from cancer. When this was happening, this was on Todd. He told me this himself. This was one of the things he wanted to do before he died. This was very, very important to him. Mm-hmm. And he did think that it was a done deal and everything had been agreed to and would be signed off on. But at this point, I mean, I think he went in the hospital like right after this meeting. He was very, very sick.
Yeah.
The meeting actually took place where he lives, and he was in bed. He was in bed. The people who were there were John, his chief of staff, Bobby Dillon, Todd, his chief of staff, Victoria Parks, who, of course, is the commissioner now, and she has had a lot to say about this, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think Patrick Duhaney, the city's manager, was there, and Jeff Aluto, the county administrator. You know, those two have to do all the work. Jeff was on the telephone for most of this meeting, and the underpinning is a little bit complicated about what's going on, because everybody really still can develop on top of these plots of land, what they want to develop. It's these underneath. It's like, was that agreement still in place of who builds the parking garages and how that revenue goes? The city says they want to blow up that deal and they'll do their part. The county does their part. And the county says that the underneath was never to be changed of how yes. that was to be built and the structure. And so it's almost like the part that people don't really see or care that much about, right? We're not talking about what's going up. And that's the problem right now, but keeps getting muddled with all kind of like, you know, little bombs here and there, like, oh, the Bengals and the parking and what's going to happen. But really what's in dispute is what's happening underneath. And the mayor, through his own, or the city, we'll say the city, how about that? The city threw its own little bomb on Friday. The city had said, okay, you can build the park, the outdoor portion of the music venue, right? That's all supposed to be part of it. The county starts building it, got the permits, went over to the city, to Master Construction, gets the permits, and they start building the park. The city revoked the permit on Friday. And it's like, what?
Wow.
So council meets last week. There's all of these things are brewing under the, you know, what's going on. Scott and I are just starting to look at these emails. And P.G. Sittenfeld put it this way. He's like, we need to get the commissioners in the same room as council. He's like, I feel like there's a lot of tennis matches going on yep. at the same time. And we're trying to watch them all. He was absolutely right. But I have to say, I don't even know how this meeting is going to help. I've already been privy to behind the scenes emails of like, well, let's have parameters. We could talk about this and not about this. And where are we going to meet and how are we going to do this? And like, I don't think some big meeting this week is going to get everything done. No. It could happen. That's the hope. But I don't see it because, of course, council has the spending approval and really the final approval of what happens there. But instead, we're hearing that's the mayor that's doing all of this. But under the constructs of the city, really is council's job to be doing this. The city, through the city manager, which that is happening, and dealing with council and what they want to see here. And council seems to have been left out of this conversation, unlike over at the county where the commissioners are briefed on everything that's happening. I mean, think about where this comes from, right? Denise Driehaus, and then Victoria issued, you know, a letter more than a week ago now, you know, really chastising the mayor and saying what she thought happened at that meeting that she was at with Todd and the mayor.
Yeah. What did you guys, anything revealing in the public records you got back on from the county on this?
I think one of, you know, a striking thing, it doesn't really get to the argument at the moment, is the idea that Mimi, you know, the symphony orchestra arm of the that's going to be programming the music venue, is like, please, please stop fighting. You know, this isn't like how we want the music venue to be revealed to the world. And so there was some of that. But I think the other more striking thing is that this meeting started falling apart. Like, everyone's it's announced to the public, it starts falling apart right away. Like, and it was behind the scenes for a long time here, but this was never what it was purported to be. It didn't work that way.
This is where if we were in studio, I think Phil could drop in a so Cincinnati little voiceover thing there, because if this isn't so Cincinnati, I don't know what is, Jerry.
No, I agree. And it's kind of sad.
I laugh, but it's not really funny. But it is kind of.
I think a lot more people are familiar with the bank since the coronavirus hit, just because of how many people are walking and using what the parks that are there now and understand like what's happening at the riverfront. And I think people are starting to pay even more attention to that music venue is flying up. It is a gigantic construction site. You can really see it now. It's so far along that you're like, oh, that's what it's going to look like. The big grand stairs up from the river to the music venue are starting to go in. I mean, it looks like it's renderings. It's a beautiful building. And then, of course, the whole secondary issue of when are we ever going to have concerts again? So that's kind of crazy. But there's we're back to, you know, ground zero is almost, it seems like, of like, what are we going to do about all of this?
I would encourage folks, if you didn't listen to last week's episode, which our special guest was former Mayor Charlie Lucan, now a lawyer with CalFE, and certainly also on the bank steering committee when it meets. Go back and listen to that, because there were some really interesting tidbits in there that he had. And I thought one of those, if you go back and listen, there was one real poignant point that he made, and that he said he didn't think it would change, it being the banks and the projects would change until the county's attorney, Tom Gableman, and the Reds owner, Bob Castellini, sort of stopped viewing this as their, to use his words, quote, little project. And I thought that was a real interesting point, and you hear it around, but to hear it, you know, on record, in an interview, for someone to point that out and just say it straight, blatantly, was a really interesting point. And I really, all my reporting, and you've done so many reporting over years, both covering the city and the county, a lot of the reporting that I've done has led right to that point. And it's that as long as those two continue to really view this as they're in control and no one else is, can really be involved here, I think you're going to have that tug of war between the city and the county, and then what are the Reds and Bengals want? And, you know, it goes to, I think, the core of who's really calling the shots. Is it the city and the county, or is it the Reds and Bengals? So I'm not asking you to comment on that, Sherry. Our conversation here made me think of that point that he made in last week's episode. So go back, and if you haven't listened, check that out, because I thought it was pretty good stuff.
You know, speaking of last week's episode, I do feel like we should update listeners. I know they already all know, because they listen and they do pay attention. I really think our listeners are, you know, big news consumers. The parks levy, after all of your reporting, it did get pulled from this year. They are going forward with the levy, the idea of it, maybe for next year, but they backed off the idea this year. And there's nobody around saying that it had anything, you know, other to do than the, you know, harsh spotlight that you put on it in your columns. So that that's where we're at right now with that.
Thank you. And there's more to come, because I think there's a lot more reporting to be done there, and on that board and on that issue, and the case, whether they can make a case for the real need for a levy, and sort of who's calling the shots over there at the board. There's a lot of red flags with that board right now. Look, the secrecy and the sneakiness of them trying to do this, I think, has brought to light some issues there, and certainly continuing to ask some questions about that. Anyway, thanks, Sherry. I think that's a good time to segue into our guest this week. And let's bring in State Representative Bridgie Kelly. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome to the podcast a loyal listener and also a state representative from right here in Cincinnati, Bridgie Kelly. Bridget, how you doing?
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
Certainly there's no shortage of things going on in your world right now. We'll jump right into the fire, and
we're going to talk about policy now, right? Like the things the state has, all the things that we want to do to make Ohio better, right? Oh, wait, there's something else going on.
That would be my preference.
I was getting ready to say that. I knew you were exactly going to say that, Bridget, and mean it, absolutely mean it too. Bridget, you know, obviously the news about Larry Householder coming out a couple weeks ago now. I know you've done a few interviews. I've mentioned in a column. When you heard that news, you know, where were you? What was your reaction to that? What went through your mind?
Well, I mean, I think that the allegation of the Speaker of the House being engaged in one of the biggest corruption scandals in the history of the state, some $60 million is pretty appalling to everyone. And I was certainly surprised and disappointed and sad, but then got more angry about it because people deserve better than that, and the people who are elected to represent them, and people should know that the folks who are elected to serve them are going to work to do our job to help them to have a better life every day, not to figure out how to build power or to, you know, do anything nefarious. And so I think it's really a black eye on the legislature. It's a black eye on the state of Ohio. I mean, it's made national news. So it's certainly a bad time, I think, for our state. And interestingly, I mean, I'm only in my second term at the state house, and, you know, really glad and excited to serve, but this is the fourth speaker we've had in about 3 years. So I think, you know, also folks are kind of like, again, seriously?
Yeah.
I mean, when people heard the news about this, they actually guessed that it was someone else. Like, that's where we were at, that, oh, really? It's not that guy? It's this guy? Like, there's a choice of, like, what people thought that this could be. And that was kind of, you know, a shocking moment for me.
Well, and I mean, I think that it also makes it really difficult for things like this to make good people consider running for office or to work in advocacy or to work in policy, because folks who are just, you know, at home working hard every day so that their family can have a nice life, so that they get the health care that they need and they can retire one day, are like, I do not want to throw my hat in that ring. I don't want to be involved with this, just because of sort of the perception of some folks. And so I think we have a lot to do in order to rebuild the public trust, and rightfully so.
I mean, a lot of people had looked upon everything with House Bill 6 with the skeptical eye, with all of the money that was flowing through. And everyone just kind of was like, we tried to get to the bottom of it, but you're like, oh, dark money. It's so hard to navigate. It's part of the system. It's a terrible thing. But it's a reality. And here we are. It's worse than we thought that it was in this case. What are people saying about these dark money checks right now? Are any talk about limiting them?
I mean,
transparency of them, even less than limiting, like making them more transparent. Is there any sort of evidence about this?
I mean, there's a lot of talk about it, but I think the question is going to be, is there actually going to be action related to it? So I think whether it's, you know, dark money or anything else in government, when you are entrusted with taxpayer money, you know, we should do things as publicly as possible, as transparently as possible. And I think that includes all these dark money PACs. And just because they're legal to use doesn't mean it's the right way to handle your business. Because if you're going to be supportive of something, or an organization's going to be supportive of something, it's no different than when we take votes, you know, in the state house. You take your stance, you own it, and you try to explain why and convince folks that that's the correct course of action. So I am hopeful that this talk will lead to action, but I think we'll have to wait and see what's ahead of us once we get back up to Columbus, where we're scheduled to be back in September.
Bridget, not to do too much looking back, but I do think it's really important that listeners and people here in greater Cincinnati know, as you live in Hyde Park, you represent, talk about all the neighborhoods, first of all, you represent, or all the area that you represent in your district.
So I am really privileged to represent communities all the way from Northside to Amberley Village, which is all some or part of about 17 neighborhoods and small municipalities, including a little bit of Mount Auburn, Clifton, Hyde Park, Oakley, Avondale, Evanston, Madisonville, Norwood, St. Bernard, and a few others in between. So it's a little bit of a circuitous route to get through our district, but it's a really diverse district. And I feel just really, really privileged to be able to serve the folks who live there.
And I just wanted to let people know, hey, what the area that you represent in the 31st district. Looking back, you were among just 12, so 38 Democrats in the House. The GOP has the supermajority currently. You were one of 12 who did not vote for, one of 12 Democrats who did not vote for Larry Householder for Speaker. You voted instead for Ryan Smith. You were House Minority Whip at the time, and House Minority Leader Fred Strayhorn also voted for Ryan Smith. I know you and I have talked about this before, but for the listeners, there's something that you saw there, and I know you had served with Brian on the Finance Committee, but do you look back on that vote now, and do you have a sense of like, I know this isn't your attitude or who you are, but is there a part of you that's like you feel like you can kind of hold your head high that you made the right, at least you yourself individually made the right vote on that, or at least what it appears as if was the right vote?
Well, I mean, that was a really complicated situation and a really challenging situation, I think, on a lot of levels. So one, it is completely unusual and entirely breaking in tradition for the minority party to be able to weigh in any sort of way when it comes to the majority party selecting their leadership team, because that's essentially what the speaker's election is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a majority party electing their leader. But there was a challenging situation because neither one of their candidates could get the requisite number of votes from within the members of their own party. So for mm-hmm. somebody like me, I prefer to vote for a Democrat all day long, over, you know, having
right.
somebody of the other party choose their leader, because that's an internal decision and should be an internal decision, you know, for the members of that party, for the members of that caucus. And so for us to have a voice in that, was highly unusual. And so, I mean, for me, I'm a union member. I care very deeply about the ability of people to be able to go to work, do it safely, make a good wage. And I would never vote for anybody that I thought would put any of that in any sort of risk or put working people in harm's way. And I mean, I've taken a lot of votes since I've been in the state house, but you know, I stand by my voting record. And I think that, you know, the things that are important to me now are the things that were important to me then. And certainly, you know, I'm not happy that the state house has been embroiled in scandal. And I'm not happy that ratepayers across the state were going to, you know, pay the price for folks who just wanted to sort of build their own power. That's not what the role of government should be. And so I'm hopeful that we will really be serious under the new leader, under Speaker Bob Kupp, about getting back to the business of really helping people to have a better life, because that's what we should have been doing all along. And so, you know, I vote against House Bill 6, and I did vote for Ryan Smith. But I mean, I stand by the votes that I made in the state house, not just those, but all of them.
Can you see House Bill 6 being repealed?
I hope so. I voted against House Bill 6. I voted against House Bill 6 as amended by the Senate. It was a bad bill to start out with. The process was extraordinarily difficult. Representative Cedric Denton was actually the ranking member on the committee that it went through. And I think he did an exceptional job, you know, trying to fight back against things that he thought were not going to be good for people in this state and in this area. But I'm hopeful that the General Assembly will go back and repeal it and get back to work. I mean, I know a lot of folks say, hey, it's a jobs bill. You know, this is what had to happen. But you know, there was never evidence that this bailout was necessary. There were never any guarantees about jobs, and there were never any promises in terms of anything related to the environment. And so I think that legislation really fell short in those three ways. And so certainly if it's repealed and replaced, those would be three things that I think that deserve to be looked at very seriously.
And we did see the governor say that he felt like it needs a whole new look. So that's kind of like, that's where we last left it, right?
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing is, you know, you have the House, the Senate, and the governor, who are, or the majority of the House, the majority of the Senate, and the governor are all the same party. But at least during my time in the state house, just because those branches are all members of the same party doesn't necessarily mean they are aligned. So I think it'll be really interesting to see if the House, the Senate, and the governor can work together in order to repeal House Bill 6 and, you know, what it may be replaced with, who knows, but I think it should certainly, you know, be repealed since it was the centerpiece of this bribery and corruption scandal.
I should mention too, for our listeners who don't know, that you work your other job besides being a state rep is that you work for the United Food and Commercial Workers, the grocery store union, which represents among many, many other employees, Kroger employees. And you referenced that you stand up for working people and for legislation to help working people. You referenced that, and I think, you know, should mention that. Part of the deal Larry Householder cut with at least 26 Democrats was that he would not push right to work legislation if the Democrats, the majority of the Democrats, would support him. And that's how he became Speaker. 26 Democrats and 26 Republicans voted for him. You were one of them, and I've written this and said this and believe this to my core, and I think any objective observer does, is that there's no bigger supporter of labor in state politics than you, Bridget. And yet you there was something there that you saw and said you stood up to that and the pressure from labor, and you stuck to your principles on that vote. And I'm not really asking anything on that. I wanted to point that out because you did reference you know, labor and some of the legislation around that. I do want to ask you now, do you sense or have any sense that now with a new speaker that right to work will come up again, or that now a new speaker, a new Republican speaker, could new Republican leadership could push right to work legislation? Have you heard any talk about that?
I mean, I haven't heard anything about it explicitly, but I would certainly hope not. I mean, I think that, first of all, you know, right to work legislation is bad because it means lower pay, less safe jobs, which is, you know, bad for communities, it's bad for workers, and then, frankly, it's bad for business in the state of Ohio. And I mean, we saw what happened. You know, although it's been a while, I don't think that, you know, sort of the core of the folks in the state have changed since Senate Bill 5 was overturned, which was, again, just another example of coming after working people and their right to join together and to negotiate for a better life. And so I think that right to work is a non-starter. It's certainly something that I will fight against all day, every day. But I think, you know, to sort of tack this on to the Householder stuff, I mean, I think that the expectation, regardless of Householder or Smith, was similar in terms of what we could, or more specifically, would not expect to be considered by the House. And again, I would never support anybody whom I thought would come after people's ability to have a better life.
You know, part of the problem right now with everything with House Bill 6, we hear these overarching arguments, but just the idea that there's other people being looked at, you know, U.S. Attorney David DeVillers said that, right? And I do feel like it has left a cloud. Do you feel like there's a lot of guessing games now about who's being talked to and what's going on? It's like, how do you move forward with, you know, such uncertainty about everyone?
I think it's really
just an uncertainty about a small group of people who we don't know.
Well, and I mean, we don't know. We really don't know, though. We don't know how far and wide the net goes. We really, you know, don't know what the extent of this is. I mean, this was a huge scandal. And, you know, I should say everybody is certainly innocent until proven guilty. But just with that cloud of suspicion sort of hanging over the State House, you know, it puts all of us in, I think, a really strange position, because, you know, we don't know who else might be involved. We don't know if there might be other things involved. And I think that creates some challenges, again, when you have one party that's sort of in charge of everything, because government is designed to have checks and balances and to be transparent. And when those things don't exist, then, you know, it creates, you know, a little bit more of an ability for something like this to happen, which is, you know, something that I would not wish on anybody, because at the end of the day, the people that get squeezed are the same people who always get squeezed. It's middle-class families that are just trying to do the right thing. It is poor folks that are counting on the government to help them to be able to get by. It's business owners that think that we should be working to help them keep their doors open. And so, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we need to be doing, not trying to figure out, you know, what's the next shoe to drop in this very nefarious situation.
Bridget, talking about Columbus and you being a Cincinnatian, and in your, like you said, in your second term, you're first elected in 2016 to the House. Have you noticed any change? And there's always been talk so many years that, hey, Cincinnati, greater Cincinnatians think of themselves as being on an island down here, and that they don't generally pay attention to what's going on in Columbus. Well, if you think about this year, if ever there's a year to really start paying attention, it would be this year, when you look at what's happened with coronavirus and all the orders that have come from the governor's office that have really dictated a lot of people's lives and livelihoods. It affects, you know, your school, your decision in schools and jobs. And then you also look at, obviously, the scandal that we're talking about here. Just from your perspective, what's the sense you've gotten from Cincinnatians? That, do you think that they are more in tune to what's going on in Columbus? They're still like, oh, okay, interesting, whatever. I'd just like to hear what you think of that.
I mean, people have a lot going on in their lives before they necessarily have, you know, space to dedicate toward paying attention to what's happening in Columbus. You know, I think a lot of folks do a really good job of covering what's going on at City Council, the Enquirer in particular. Mm-hmm. And I think folks really stay tuned in to that. But I think it's also on us who represent this area in the State House to keep talking about what's happening up there, to keep discussing, hey, you know, these are proposed bad changes that, you know, want to happen to the election system. These are proposed, you know, bad changes that are made to, you know, your healthcare options. These are proposed changes to whatever, to make that information more accessible to people. Because, you know, there's so much going on. There are so many outlets for people to get their news that it is imperative that we make it available to people so that when they want to and when they choose to consume it, that it's available to them, but also so that we remind them about these really huge, you know, impactful decisions that we're making in Columbus that are ultimately going to impact them at their kitchen table every single day.
And you started this, I believe it was in your first term, didn't you start lawmakers in your neighborhood, legislatures, and you had a
State House in your neighborhood. Yeah,
State House in your neighborhood.
Could back when we could be within 6 feet of one another. Because, you know, it's not always convenient for, or, you know, practical or possible for people to be able to come up to Columbus and have a meeting. We don't have an office down here. So we would just, you know, set up shop at a library or a coffee house so that if people had questions or wanted to talk about what was on their mind, it's just sort of open office hours. But since the coronavirus, Representative Jessica Miranda, Representative Catherine Ingram, Representative Cedric Jensen, and I every Friday have been holding sort of virtual town halls called Lunch with Your Legislators.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we'll either have a panel focused on something or just sort of like open dialogue with all of us to talk about what's going on in Columbus and to connect people with resources here in their community.
And that's all four of the Hamilton County Democratic state lawmakers who do that, what'd you say, every week?
Every Friday at 11 o'clock. You can check us out on Facebook Live or via Zoom.
Let's bring it back here to Cincinnati and local politics. And certainly every time Bridgie Kelly's name comes up, or every time a different office comes up, Bridgie Kelly's name comes up oftentimes. You know, I've even at some point along the line, your name was bandied about for mayor or council or a commissioner or and now that you put out a statement. I don't know, what was that, in June? There'd been a lot of rumors swirling around, I guess, for several months about you being interested or potentially interested in running for county auditor, and you put out a statement on that. What'd you say, or tell folks what your thoughts are on that?
So, well, I mean, it's certainly a huge compliment to have my name among consideration for, you know, a number of different things. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate people's consideration of that. I will say I am on the ballot for state rep this November, so really trying to stay focused on that and also to electing Joe Biden president. Because I think that is one of the most consequential elections, certainly. There was a little bit of controversy happening over some comments by the auditor recently, which, you know, I just said that I disagreed with. But it's, you know, certainly something that I am taking a serious look at. But right now, just really trying to focus on the 2020 election and making sure we get folks turned out to vote for everybody from president to judges to county commission. So I think we have plenty to do over the next few weeks related to that.
You know, I have seen on social media, you've been out door knocking. What is it like in coronavirus trying to campaign? And also, I'm wondering what you're hearing from people that you're talking to.
So I will tell you, Sherry, like, I love to knock doors. It's one of my favorite things to do is to go out and talk to people. And we're not able to do that sort of traditional canvassing right now. So we're really just going out and lit dropping, and any interactions you have with folks are pretty happenstance. And so it makes them a little more infrequent. But I think that at least the folks that I've talked to are excited about the election. There's a lot of questions though about what that's going to look like, especially with what's happening at the post office and, you know, the things that Trump has done recently. I think people are a little bit apprehensive just sort of about that. People are stressed out about what's going to happen with their kids going back to school and with their jobs. And so with so much uncertainty, I think that they're excited for the opportunity to go and vote and support people that they know are going to be working for them every single day, which is people like Joe Biden and Alicia Reese and the folks who are on, you know, the Democratic sample ballot.
Bridget, I want to jump back quickly to auditor, and you referenced Dusty Rhodes, and we had him on the podcast right after he put out that tweet that, you know, you were referencing. Is this something that you could potentially, and he's up for re-election not until 2022, so a little down the road, but is this something you are thinking you may primary him? If
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's still a lot of time to speculate about what might happen. But I will say, you know, Duffy has been in office for a long time. And, you know, there's never been a hint of scandal in his office. There has never been any issues. And so I think anybody with that kind of track record, I mean, that's an impressive thing, especially, you know, as somebody with a front seat to all the nonsense that's happening at the State House. So, I mean, I think there's still a lot of time before 2022 to figure out what may or may not happen.
I will say, I believe this is the portion of the podcast where Jason refers to as the hot seat. He's like, we're going to bring it right back to that. So what do you think? Anyway.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I'm excited to continue to serve my constituents at the State House. We're still working on some stuff that we're hopeful we can get accomplished in the rest of this term. And then, you know, every term is sort of 2 years worth of opportunities to do as much good for the greatest number of people as possible. And so that's stuff that we really try to keep in mind. So we're working hard to pass sports betting to provide more money for education. You know, I'm going to keep on fighting to raise the minimum wage in the state of Ohio. That's something that's really important to me. We're going to fight to make sure that people have access to their pay statements. One of the things I'm really proud of that we accomplished in this term was finally passing the pink tax so that period products would be exempt from sales tax. And that's something that had been in the works for a long time. So that's something that we're really, really proud of because it's a practical thing that makes a big difference in the lives of people every day.
And I remember, I'll never forget this, right when I got on the political beat in early 2016, and I'm talking to Tim Burke, the then chairman of the local Democratic Party, and he mentioned, one of the people he brought up first was you, and he said, Bridget Kelly is exactly the kind of candidate that we want everyone to be, and that she came up and volunteered on people's campaigns. She never, you know, had an ego. You asked her to go print off flyers or go make phone calls to donors or go out and knock hundreds of doors on a Saturday, hot Saturday afternoon. Bridget Kelly was the person who was willing and ready and volunteering, raising her hands. How important is that, something that you really truly believe in, that real, and I know this is an overused word, but that grassroots sort of core hard work interaction with the voters approach. Do you see a lot of other folks coming up in politics or wanting to be running for elected office someday, willing to do that kind of work?
I mean, I think everybody runs their campaigns a little bit differently. I mean, I'm fortunate. My family has been involved in public service. And so I kind of came up in that and have always loved it. And I don't think there is any more valuable use of time than talking to voters and talking to people about what's most important to them, because that's how we can do the best job representing the people that we do. Because if you don't know what's important to people, and if you're not talking to them about the things that are going on, then how can you be an effective representative of them? And so, you know, going to community council meetings and talking to people on their front porch is really meaningful, whether it is, you know, for our campaign or for someone else's. I think those one-on-one interactions they're really special. And I feel incredibly privileged to have the opportunity for people to have really serious conversations about things that deeply impact their lives. And I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to do it. It looks a little bit different, certainly this time around, but, you know, it's awesome to be out in a neighborhood and, you know who lives at the house on the corner and the one three doors down, and you can watch the kids sort of grow up since the first time you came by knocking doors on that street. Yeah. And that's just something that's really, really special.
And you've been doing, you said you were, your dad involved in Norwood politics, and you grew up and you were a former Norwood council member before you went on to run for state rep. So do you, do you worry that that's a lost thing in politics, that literally just getting out there, you know, getting off of Facebook and getting off of, you know, sending emails to people and just getting out there and walking neighborhoods?
I mean, I think all of it is important, but there's something to be said for if folks call your office and say, hey, you know, there's a pothole in this part of the street, or hey, you know, this is going on, and to know exactly what they're talking about. One of the best things that ever happened when I knocked on doors was, you know, I was calling people in the primary, seeing if they needed, you know, help or if I could be of service. And they said, hey, you know, the curb in front of my house is crumbling and the person's wife was in a wheelchair. And he said, it's really hard for us to maneuver her chair over that. And so we made some calls to city council and they said, hey, you know, we're going to take care of this. And so a couple months later, I was out knocking doors for the general and I saw this name on my list. And I thought, oh, you know, that looks familiar, but couldn't quite place it. And so I knocked on the door. And as soon as this gentleman opened the door, he said, Bridget, I'm so glad to see you. Have you seen my curb? And that to me is just like what this work is all about, because that is something that makes his life, his wife's life, his family's life better every day. And so that was for sure one of the high points, I think, for me, because it was really impactful to them.
Yeah.
I mean, those are stories you don't hear all the time. Like, and it is those types of things. Jason and I see that in our work. Like, we write stories every day, and I know you take votes and do work every day. And every once in a while, you hear something like come back to you, and it's like, well, that made a difference. You're like, oh, that's right. Like, that is why we do that.
And I think that's why, you know, it's so important both for elected folks and, you know, for journalists right now, particularly. I mean, you guys have a really difficult job, but people need to know what's going on in their government or what's not going on in their government.
Great, great stuff, Bridget. Thanks so much for taking all this time today to join us on the podcast. And definitely we'll be catching up with you and keeping up with you on things that are coming up here in the State House.
Look forward to it. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks, Bridget.
Take good care.
Thanks again to State Representative Bridget Kelly. Now, Sherry, we've transitioning into the fun segment of the show. Fall is right around the corner, Sherry. I saw something last week. Somebody brought up pumpkin spice lattes. I'm like, oh, no, please, no, not yet. Not ready for the summer.
I'm not letting go of summer till the last gasp. I think part of it is like I've just rediscovered summer and all of the parks and going outside. There's been some, you know, crisp air in the mornings. I'm just totally ignoring it. And I'm holding on to summer. So I just want you to know that. I'll let you know when I'm ready for fall. And I think it'll be like around Christmas.
I was at Walmart last night. Just run some errands, picking up some grocery items, and I'm walking by. I just walk around Walmart, and I'm walking by the clothes. And I look over, and like there's flannel shirts and like fleece vests, fake fleece vests. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I guess fall is like basically in a month, or you know, sort of considered a month.
I know Labor Day. Halloween stuff's gonna be coming out, and like that doesn't change. But again, I'm ignoring it. You worried about anything this fall? I know you are.
Very worried. causing me a little bit of angst. I don't think college football is going to happen. As we're recording this, it's still on for now. The Mid-American Conference is canceled, but we're actually recording this on a Monday. And
you know, I'm a Bowling Green girl. It's hard even imagine. Like Saturdays without football, college.
Yes,
everything's
it is.
Different now. It just is.
My Marshall Thundering Herd, the Bearcats, the Buckeyes. I love it all, and it's a big deal for my brother and I. He's a Marshall alum, and it kind of brings us together. And now that our parents have moved away from our hometown in Southeast Ohio, it's sort of a fun thing we really like to do. The kind of you know, bonds us to go to Marshall games and tailgate. And so to not be able to do that this fall is especially just after this year. And like, he's a police officer, and I know that he was really looking forward to kind of having, you know, this handful of weekends just get away. And so,
and really not do it, because you can't even say, like, some things during this pandemic, you're like, well, you just do them at home or amend these things. But this is, it's right. Really, we're really on cancellation here. And you can't even be like, well, on Saturdays, we'll do some TV. It's not happening.
In the grand scheme of things, it's just sports. And we will all get through it. And there'll be college football again, I would hope, at least in 2021 fall, potentially even in the next spring. So, but yes, I need something to do this fall. What am I going to do on my fall Saturday, Sherry?
Work. Sorry.
We all know that's already both of our hobbies is work.
It definitely is.
Journalism and college football, my hobbies. Although you've helped me get another hobby, kayaking.
Yes, that's a good thing to do in the fall. Good. You just start dressing warmer. It's a fall activity too.
Yes, it is. We have to go again.
Switching to pit walks and, you know, afternoons there with actual hikes through our parks. That's a good thing.
Yes. That's a good idea. I'll find something to do. What do you got going on?
I haven't started again. I'm holding on to summer as long as I possibly can. I will say the one fall thing I did think about is the Rubber Duck Regatta. Mm-hmm. You know, I got some emails. Normally at this time, all of the news media have something called the Quacky Games. And we all compete against each other on various, like, obstacle courses. Last year was on Fountain Square. I'm not going to lie. I thought it was, like, very, you know, the rope swings. And it was really hard last year. I thought I was going to die. But real quick, the Inquirer did win. I'm going to have to put that out there.
Burl, the competitor. I think of the Quacky Games. It's you, Burl, and Rasputin Todd, who's our entertainment editor, things to do.
And one of our producers last year did it with us.
Okay.
I always think of you three, though.
Like, you guys are so into that. So.
But it's a fun thing, but it's really meant to raise awareness for the Rubber Duck Regatta, which raises money for the Free Store Food Bank, which, you know, we talked a lot about. You know, we had Kurt Reiber, the CEO, on at Thanksgiving time, which was a great mm-hmm. time to have him on. But this is really it right now. Like, there's been unprecedented need during the coronavirus. We've talked about it ourselves, but it's very serious. And they don't know what this Rubber Duck Regatta, this is the biggest fundraiser of the year. Yeah. You buy a duck, you have a chance to win a car, I think. I forget what the prizes are. I never win things like that. So it's really more about donating than actually what I might win. And they're still selling the ducks. And I don't know. They don't know what it's going to look like, it said. But for $25, you can buy a duck, chance to win these prizes, and you can feed 15 families. And so I might not be doing the Quacky Games, but I do want to remind everyone we have to buy these ducks for our community.
Those are available on their website, right?
Yes. That's where I went and found it. And I did get some emails from past donations. But it's, you know, it's the Free Store Food Bank, and it's ground zero for an entire region of food and solving hunger.
That's freestorefoodbank.org, freestorefoodbank.org. Right when you go onto their website, it gives you an option to buy a duck right away. You can click this little window for the 26th annual Rubber Duck Regatta. Buy a duck, feed a child. Great. Really glad you brought that up, Sherry, because certainly the need is there. I think you and I have both had conversations with people. We've seen headlines about it that people are struggling out there. And, you know, I was talking to Alicia Reese about this not too long ago. Like, even people who have never found themselves in a position where they've had to struggle or they've struggled are now finding themselves in that position. And so, yeah, certainly if ever there's a year or two, if you can really step up and help out, this is that year. So really glad you brought that up, Sherry.
All right, so that's my fun thing this week.
Yeah.
I have a lot of you know, good memories attached to it, and it's fun. And so many of the different, you know, charity fundraisers, you know, are really fun things. Paddle Fest, these things actually, the Flying Pig, all these things actually raise money for charity. And yeah, them not happening means we're not having fun, but they're also putting all of the people who rely on the money in very scary positions. So, all right, I don't want to like go on and on about it. But so this isn't the only one that's different like this.
Great stuff. You know, just remind folks, hey, you haven't gotten your digital subscription yet. They're still available for 99 cents. Just go to 99 cents for the first 3 months. I think just what we've talked about here today on the podcast, I feel like really shows the value of our journalism with the public records deep dive that Sherry and Scott Wortman did on the banks, the stuff that I've done on the parks district on Great Parks. I think those two things alone just show that, hey, without your support, we can't do this watchdog work, this public accountability work. Go check it out, cincinnati.com/subscribe. All your options are there. And certainly continue to, you know, if you need to contact us, our email, jwilliams@inquirer.com, scoolidge@inquirer.com, Twitter @jwilliamscincy with a Y, @SharonCoolidge on, @SharonCoolidge on Twitter as well. And hey, thanks again for your support of the podcast. And we will catch you next week.